Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So here's a decision for the Democrats that you might think they've already made by now. What is impeachment actually about? Well, Speaker Pelosi, it's about Ukraine, right?
But this isn't about Ukraine. This is about Russia, who benefited by our withholding of that military assistance. Russia. It's about Russia. So sometimes people say, well, I don't know about Ukraine. I don't know that much about Ukraine. Well, our adversary in this is Russia. All roads lead to Putin. Understand that.
Speaker Pelosi yesterday at a news conference, it's not about Ukraine, it's about Russia. But that came shortly after the speaker said this in announcing that an abuse of power article of impeachment will now be drawn up.
The facts are uncontested. The president abused his power for his own personal political benefit at the expense of our national security by withholding military aid and crucial Oval Office meeting in exchange for an announcement of an investigation into his political rival.
Well, that sounds like it's about Ukraine. The president abused his power for his own personal benefit at the expense of our national security by withholding military aid in a crucial Oval Office meeting in exchange for an announcement of investigation into his political rival, Ukraine. Of course, impeachment could be about Russia and Ukraine. It could also be about emoluments and the hush money ruling and the stealing from charity admission last month in court and obstructing justice and threatening a new civil war. Is that an act of treason? But how broad, how narrow should they make it? These articles of impeachment are supposed to be finished in just a few days. So we'll talk about that and other impeachment news now with Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine staff writer, Slate Political Gabfest co-host, lecturer and senior research scholar at the Yale Law School, and author of the book, which seems to land on another best of 2019 list every day, called Charged, The Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Happy Friday, Emily. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
How much do you hear those two Pelosi statements from yesterday as contradictory, or how much as part of a cohesive whole?
The Russia-Ukraine question doesn't seem to me to be a contradiction, because we're talking about the United States' relationship with Russia and the Ukraine, and Russia's role as an aggressor in Ukraine a couple of years ago and the American response to that. I do think, though, the other questions you raised about the breadth of impeachment are still kind of hanging on there for the Democrats. There are a lot of ways in which they could argue that Trump has abused his power. Emoluments is one. You can go back to some of the aspects of the Mueller investigation if you want to go there. And then the question is whether that's a mistake, and it's better to stick with this easier to comprehend story about, which really comes down to trying to use foreign influence to steal the election or cheat on the election.
Is it sort of politics versus history? Like, I think the tension is real between making the strongest possible narrow case for clarity of communication to the public. He shook down Ukraine to help corrupt the 2020 election. Clear. And then there's the broader case, which is what history might record 100 years from now. He engaged in a pattern of abusing his power for personal gain, which from beginning to end also benefited our adversary, Russia, which he knew was trying to destabilize American democracy. But the narrower case is much more concrete. So I'm curious, for you who are both a research scholar and a lawyer, would it be right to say you can relate to this tension between what's useful in the real world right now and what's the deepest possible understanding for the long run?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to frame it. I mean, I guess in a sort of lawyerly way, I've been thinking about the tension between, okay, if you frame articles of impeachment and you make them narrow, have you just said everything else was okay?
Yeah.
And is that a problem, right? Because then you sort of excused for the future, as you were putting it, a pattern of conduct, which maybe we shouldn't excuse.
Listeners, we can take your calls on this. Do you want narrower articles of impeachment. This is, of course, for you who want articles of impeachment at all. But if you do, do you want narrower articles of impeachment or broader ones? Do you have your eye more on the political arc of swing voters or the big arc of history? Or do you think those two don't have to be in conflict? 212-433-WNYC or anything you want to ask Emily Bazelon about the impeachment news, but never had her over for dinner. 212-433-9692. Emily, I could imagine a top line statement that allows a lot of flexibility underneath, that says something like, he abused his power by buying and selling influence with foreign countries for his own political gain, then abused his power again to try to cover it up. That's pretty direct, excuse me, and clear, I think. Then they could fill in the particulars that they think they can use to prove it to the public.
Right. And then do they say something like, for example, which then makes it more concrete, allows them to lay out the specifics, but also kind of hedges and suggests that, well, there could be other examples out there.
Right. And since they're in this actual articles of impeachment writing moment, I looked up the Bill Clinton articles of impeachment for just this question. And as you know, there were four of them originally, and they seemed to go with a general accusation of the abuse and then a numbered list of particulars. So, for example, Article 1 was Clinton has willfully corrupted and manipulated the judicial process of the United States for his personal gain. There's personal gain again. For his personal gain and exoneration, impeding the administration of justice. And then number one, the nature that says perjury. And then number one, the nature and details of his relationship with a subordinate government employee, Monica Lewinsky. Number two, they're numbered. Number two, prior perjurious false and misleading testimony he gave in a federal civil rights action, Paula Jones, brought against him. Three, prior false and misleading statements he allowed his attorney to make to a federal judge. And then there was a fourth one, too. So overarching charge followed by specific alleged instances. Do you think it'll probably go like that?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense as a way to frame it, right? And for Clinton, by the time of impeachment, there was perjury and there was obstruction. And it was like pretty clear, I think, right? I mean, it's not like Republicans approved of other things he did, but that's what they were focused on.
Right. I noticed how many New Yorkers and Californians are leading this article drafting process. The committee chairs involved are all from the two states, unless I'm missing something. Gerald Nadler from New York City is the Judiciary Committee chair. Carolyn Maloney chairs the Oversight Committee. She's from New York City. Elliot Engel chairs the Foreign Affairs Committee. Maxine Waters and Adam Schiff from California chair Finance and Intelligence, respectively. I think those are all the committees drawing up the articles of impeachment, and it's really the chairs who Pelosi says are doing it. And Pelosi is from California, too. So the articles of impeachment may not be bipartisan, but they will be bicoastal.
Yeah, that's a good point. As a resident of Connecticut, I guess I should feel kind of left out. And certainly the Republicans can make some hay with the lack of representation from anywhere other than the two coasts.
Yeah, but you get too many senators and too many electoral votes. The next public hearing is scheduled for Monday. In the Judiciary Committee, they're saying presentation of evidence by lawyers for certain committees from both parties. How clear is it to you what will happen on Monday?
I think we will hear this all laid out in concrete terms. We had a day this week of law professors, really, making more abstract constitutional arguments for and kind of against impeachment, or at least against the process the Democrats are using for impeachment. That was from Jonathan Turley, who was the Republicans' law professor representative. So now I think we're going to turn to the specifics and some of the questions you and I were just talking about. How do you frame this? What facts do you emphasize? How clear a case can you make?
For people who watch the public hearings in the Intelligence Committee, they know the Democratic staff attorney, Daniel Goldman, and Republican staff attorney Steve Castor, who questioned the witnesses, all those witnesses, Colonel Vindman, Fiona Hill, all of them. Is it going to be like oral arguments then, almost like at the Supreme Court? These attorneys now are going to be the ones answering the questions, no new fact witnesses, but lawyers kind of presenting oral arguments?
Yeah, I think it will be more like that. I'm not sure how much the members of Congress will be able to interrupt the other side, whether it's still going to be conducted in a kind of question answer form or whether lawyers will be able to speak uninterrupted for longer periods of time. The Supreme Court has actually adopted a new rule where they're trying to let lawyers talk a little bit, at least at the top, before they start going at them. And the idea is that makes for a more coherent presentation.
Let's take a phone call. Diana in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Emily Bazelon. Hi, Diana.
Hi, yes. Hi, Brian. I wanted to say, first of all, I don't see the contradiction in what Nancy Pelosi said, that, and I do think we need to highlight the national security issue in the impeachment proceedings by withholding military aid from Ukraine. Ukraine is dealing with Russia as an aggressor, so that affects us as Russia expanding is potentially then a greater threat to us. His weakening our relationship with NATO, that jeopardizes our national security. Also, his, I don't know if this is impeachable, but his not protecting and appointing people who are actually the opposite of the their responsibility. He points to whose interests are financial rather than actually what they're supposed to be. So, for example, in our environment, we are getting a more dangerous, insecure, toxic environment. He's not protecting us. He's also threatening the democracy by all his obstructions of justice, all his assumptions of his lying. He's threatening the freedom of press as the fourth estate. He's by condemning the press so much and trying to sow so much lack of faith in them and confusion. So that's throwing off our democracy, which depends on our trust in a free press and an objective press. And again, his obstruction of justice is overthrowing the balance between the Congress, the president, and the Supreme Court.
See, but Diana, I think you're articulating the tension perfectly, which is that for you and so many other Americans, people's hair is on fire or are on fire. Your hair is on fire. People's hair is on fire because you think he's, attacking our democracy and corrupting it and turning it into an authoritarian form of government to the extent that he can in so many ways. But then it starts to lose people with their eyes glazing over in a haze when we list so many things, right?
Right. I don't know whether it actually helps or not, so that's a judgment for others. But I do think we need to, I think these are really important that a large part of the GOP understand that things that we take for granted, our freedoms, the way that our democracy functions, our security in the world. I think these are, our water, the quality of our water and other aspects of our environment. I think these are so important, and they are part of his responsibility as president. So perhaps we can, because they all fit a single theme, that he's not helping this country, even though he keeps saying it's better than ever.
Diana, thank you so much. Call us again. And Judy in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi, thank you. What I want is simple, emoluments. I want to add enough information about how public money, our tax money, is going into his pockets. It doesn't come up nearly enough. Every time the Secret Service go to Mar-a-Lago, money for their rooms, their food, their drink, their golf cart, whose pocket does it go into? Including in the context of Ukraine. Let's say Hunter Biden made $1 million there. Whose pocket does it go into? Hunter Biden's. Whereas everywhere that Donald Jr. goes, whose pocket does it go into? Well, his pockets are still attached to his father's because Trump Sr. never divested. So I think American citizens can understand, follow the money.
Judy, thank you very much. And my guest, Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine staff writer, Yale Law School lecturer and senior researcher and member of the Slate Political Gabfest. Emily, do you think they will go to emoluments? Do you think they should go to emoluments?
I think they won't in this impeachment context. I understand why people are so frustrated about this. And I also think it is kind of simple. It's like, well, we have this clause in the Constitution that says the president can't accept gifts from, it's really from foreign agents. There are two emoluments clause, but that's like the clear one. And it seems like that's happening. So why isn't someone doing something about it? People have sued. Congress has sued. Those cases are making their way through the courts. I don't think they're going to become part of impeachment. And I do think there is a case for just making impeachment narrow and clearer and sticking to one message about it.
Emily, Republicans today are expressing outrage about some of the phone records included in the House Intelligence Committee Democrats' impeachment report, the Adam Schiff report, released on Tuesday, because it contains records of what phone numbers Devin Nunes and Rudy Giuliani, for example, were talking to in a number of cases. The Republicans are raising Fourth Amendment search and seizure concerns. They describe it as Adam Schiff doing what he's accusing Trump of, using his government power to target political enemies. Here's Senator Rand Paul talking about this.
And I'm alarmed at the abuse of power by Adam Schiff. Did you see yesterday it was released that he's actually spying on other members of Congress and journalists by using his subpoena power to get their phone calls? This is abhorrent. This is exactly what he's accusing the president of, using the power of government to go after political opponents. This should never happen. And I'm going to work hard to make sure that in the future, people like Adam Schiff do not have the power to abuse government to go after their political rivals.
Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky on Fox. Emily, do they have a point on this?
Well, I mean, there's like a global question about the rules for getting this kind of phone call data, which, let's be clear, we're talking about a log of who you called, not what you said on the phone. The power to do that comes from a 1970s Supreme Court opinion. You have to get a warrant. So there's that. And a congressional warrant is different from a warrant in a court. So, you know, if you're a strong civil libertarian, the way Rand Paul is, the idea that Congress could go to AT&T or whoever the phone provider was and get this information, yeah, that could seem like an alarming intrusion.
And they didn't get a search warrant to do it, I understand, from a court. The law allowed them to do that, and Senator Paul didn't allege it was illegal, but he alleged it was unethical and an abuse of power that was targeting people for political reasons. The evidence indicates Giuliani was calling the White House, possibly the budget office, though that detail now seems unclear. But in any case, it was around when some of these Ukraine questions were being decided, and the budget office is apparently where the military aid got stopped. There are other questions about Ukrainians Nunes was talking to, like Lev Parnas, indicted now for U.S. campaign finance violations in support of Ukrainian business people to get Ambassador Marie Ivanovich fired. Was Nunes involved with that is one of the questions. I'm just curious what you make of the substance of the fact that, you know, these phone records indicate the conversations that they indicate.
I mean, I don't think it's definitive proof, but it's suggestive, right? It means that there were these communications going on among people who were all involved in the actions you were just talking about. And why else would Giuliani be calling the OMB but to talk to them about the possibility of freezing this military aid or something else to do with Ukraine? And he's not a government official, so what's he doing having that kind of role? These are the questions.
Right.
You know,
and when Giuliani's case, it's because he's not a government official. What is the president's private lawyer doing calling OMB? If it turns out that he was actually calling OMB to mess around, and when military aid gets released to Ukraine, and in Devin Nunes' case, if he's talking to Lev Parnas, like Giuliani was always talking to Lev Parnas, and Parnas has been indicted for illegally using foreign influence to get Marie Ivanovich fired, was Nunes in on that plot? So the plot thickens.
Exactly. And obviously for Nunes to be there as part of the Intelligence Committee, but also implicated, you know, that's like a classic conflict of interest or dual role that one wonders about.
There's a part of me that says on Giuliani, because, you know, he's back in Ukraine now meeting with former officials and others for a report of their own. And some legal analysts are raising eyebrows because Giuliani is under investigation for some of his Ukraine adventures that might have been illegal. And yet there's a part of me that says, ignore or laugh at Rudy Giuliani as people are doing at your peril. He's had all this success as a prosecutor, an investigator, two-time campaigner for mayor in Blue New York, and he's a true believer in Trumpism, and he's very motivated, even if people think he's a little crazy now.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, there is just this, like, this way in which people's roles are developing. We can see these incentives and these cross interests that we couldn't really see before.
I want to play the angry Joe Biden moment from yesterday and get your thoughts. He's at a campaign stop in Iowa, and a guy says Biden sent his son, he used the word sent his son to work in Ukraine, and accused Biden of, quote, selling access to the president, presumably meaning access to President Obama for the company Burisma. And Biden got mad. Here's the exchange. And listeners, you'll hear the guy is not on mic so well. You'll hear Biden better, but you get the idea.
You're selling access to the president just like he is.
A damn liar, man. That's not true. And no one has ever said that. No one has heard that. No. You see it on the TV. No, I know you do. And by the way, that's why I'm not sedentary. I get up and no, let him go. Let him go. Look, the reason I'm running is because I've been around a long time and I know more than most people know. And I can get things done. That's why I'm running. And you want to check my shape on, let's do push-ups together here, man. Let's run. Let's do whatever you want to do. Let's take another piece of it. Number two. No one has said my son has done anything wrong, and I did not on any occasion. And no one has ever said it.
I didn't say you were doing anything wrong.
I set up my son to work in an oil company. Isn't that what you said? Get your words straight, Jack.
You're on MSNBC.
You don't hear that on MSNBC. You did not hear that at all. What you heard? Look, okay, I'm not going to get in an argument with you, man. Well, yeah, you do, but look, fat. Look, here's the deal.
And that went on for even a little while longer. And you heard the applause there from the people who were at a Democratic, campaign event. Republicans are framing this as Biden losing it because he has something to hide. Can you put on your Slate political gabfest hat for a second and say how you see that exchange politically in Democratic primary terms?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is going to be a divide over this, right? Like, some people are going to say, yeah, Biden stuck up for himself. Of course, he's frustrated. This was an opportunity for him to make it clear that, he had nothing to do with Hunter Biden's role in Burisma, the gas company in Ukraine, and it's fine that he got a little hot under the collar. Like, he's human. And then there's a question of whether it was intemperate and kind of over the top, and did he really have a coherent response, and should he have been picking on a voter? I think it's always tricky when you let your emotions run away with you a little bit, and the person you're talking to is just like an ordinary American.
Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine staff writer, Slate Political Gabfest co-host, lecturer, and senior research scholar at the Yale Law School, and author of Charged, The Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.